Bill Rafuss was the chief investigating officer at the Saskatchewan Human Rights Commission for over 25 years. He retired in 2012 and continues doing freelance workplace investigations. Active in the Saskatoon Amnesty International chapter and global gathering place, he has worked in Africa, the Caribbean, and Mongolia. In 2015, Bill was elected to a two-year term on the board of Amnesty International Canada, the English-speaking section. In addition to his amnesty work, Bill is a sessional lecturer at the University of Saskatchewan. Bill?
I am going to try to talk to you today about human rights, perhaps from a bit more philosophical perspective than from just an amnesty perspective. So let's go on this little bit of a journey together and see where we end up. Maybe I could start by saying that I had a look at your seven guiding principles and was very impressed with them, of course. And I'm happy to say I've lived my life, most of my life, following those very same principles without knowing them in advance. And so I hope I can share some of those experiences with you today to give you an idea of the path I've taken that is, again, very consistent with the path that you're on as well. First, a little bit of context, maybe a little bit of a repeat of what Helen said, but give you a little bit more context. I was born and raised in Saskatoon and continue to live there today. Drove down this morning and had a lovely drive and a beautiful sunny spring morning. I did live in Regina for about 6 years, and so I'm very familiar with the city. It's always nice to come back and see old friends and recall old memories as well. All three of my now adult children were born in Regina, actually, so that's a very special connection that I have. My first job at a university many years ago now was as a community legal services worker working with the Saskatchewan Legal Aid Plan. And I was providing basic legal information to people who were in need, people before the courts, people in jail and others, under the supervision, of course, of senior lawyers. But looking back on it now, I think that sort of set the stage for what I did for the rest of my life, really. At the time, it, in terms of years and so on, it seemed a little insignificant, but now I'm starting to realize it was actually very important. And so I did start down the same path that you're on in many ways. Oh, welcome to Gord. I then moved over to the Human Rights Commission, and as Helen indicated, I was there for 28 and a half years, 25 years as the chief investigating officer, work I very much enjoyed and provided me with so many varied experiences. I continue to do freelance investigations, as she indicated, that's really without a lot of marketing on my part either, I must say. I get phone calls out of the blue from people who have a bit of a problem in their workplace, and I'm happy to go in and try to sort it out for them. I did retire, though, in 2012, and had been teaching at the university for some time, sort of overlapping with that experience at the Human Rights Commission. Began teaching political studies, actually, at the University of Saskatchewan 10 years ago, 2006, and I continue to do that today, both at the University of Saskatchewan and St. Thomas More College, where I'm a sessional instructor there as well. My specialty, such that it is Canadian politics, Canadian government, but I also teach a course in the Charter of Rights, and I hope to do that again this fall. My thesis was on the issue of the Charter of Rights as it applies to Indigenous people in Canada. Once I retired, though, I wanted very deliberately to immerse myself back in the volunteer sector, in the nonprofit sector. I began as a volunteer at Global Gathering Place in Saskatoon. Some of you may be aware of it. It's a newcomer settlement agency, much like the Regina Open Door Society, one of three or four in Saskatoon with 35 staff and a budget of now $2.4 million. Very active place. So I started there as a volunteer in 2012, and the next year was asked to serve on the board of directors, which I gladly did. And in 2014, I was elected president of that group, and that's a position that I hold today as chairman of the board. With the arrival of the Syrian refugees in Canada and Saskatchewan, where it's a very busy place, believe me. So busy, in fact, that we're opening a second location to accommodate additional English as a secondary language programming. But I also reintegrated myself into Amnesty International. I had been somewhat on the sidelines of the organization, had taken part in a number of events over the years, but was very committed to rejoining in 2012, and that's what I did. Rejoined Group 33 in Saskatoon and very much enjoyed that experience. In 2015, I decided to run for the National Board of Amnesty International Canada at the AGM in Halifax and was successful in being elected to a two-year term, ending in 2017. So I have a fair bit of background in that area. I got my master's later in life, and although I felt I had some academic training, I felt I was still missing sort of the real-life experience aspect of that, even though I'd worked in human rights all of my life. And so in about 2008, I decided to try to get a new master's degree in real life, not at the university, but in the real life. And so I set about on a rather lengthy journey, went to Africa four times, five times in total. I'd been there before 2008. Been to China three times, Mongolia twice. I was an election observer in Kenya in 2013 and in Mongolia in 2009 in the capital, Ulaanbaatar. I've been to Egypt three times, all of during the height of the Arab Spring revolutions there and the counter-revolutions that followed. This collection of experiences has given me a fair bit of insight, I think, into some of the issues around the world that I think we all need to try to solve and to be a part of and to try to understand a little bit more than perhaps we did before. And so that's what I'm going to try to focus on today. With that kind of background, I'll try to focus on some of those issues today. Let me start by saying that one of the key points I'll make is that Canada is a very rights-conscious country. We have a modern Charter of Rights, one of the most modern in the world, actually, replicated to a certain extent by South Africa once their new government was formed. But we have human rights codes at every level of government and at the municipal levels. We have anti-bullying bylaws and race relations and so on. Canada has signed on to most of the international treaties and accords. So human rights do matter in Canada. But we can't take that for granted because we found in the past 9 or 10 years, not to be too specific about it, a certain rise in Islamophobia, pushback on transgender inclusion, and other pride rights, so-called pride rights, like gay straight alliances. We've seen a rise in the incarceration of Aboriginal Canadians and others, and yet a seeming lack of concern about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Because I teach political studies, I tend to sometimes look at life through a political lens. I hope also a human rights lens. So you'll have to pardon me if I get a little bit too political. But I am concerned about the snitch lines and dividing our population and all the things we hear Donald Trump talking about as well, right? These are the challenges that a modern society faces. And while we want to have space for public discussion on those kinds of issues, we also have to be very vigilant in terms of what it's doing in terms of our human rights record. So my point was we are a rights-conscious society, but there's always pushback on that, and so we have to be vigilant. And I think we saw, with the former government at least, that they were prepared to push us in a different direction. And fortunately for the people of Canada, we said no on October 19th last year. We felt that it wasn't part of our traditions in terms of where that government wanted to take us. So I see the election not just in partisan terms, but in the sense that Canadians kind of regained their values, recovered their values, restored them to where they were before. And that's very encouraging. If I had to give a label to my little talk today, it would probably be two step forwards, one step back, as opposed to one step forward, two step back. I do think we're making progress, but there are challenges that continue to push us back, and we have to be vigilant about that. That's my point number two. Canadians have to hold their politicians to account for continuing to promote and protect human rights in Canada. This is up to us. This is not up to our elected officials to decide what our position should be on these various issues. It's up to us to inform the politicians and to hold them to account for positions they take. In Canada, you don't have to agree with everybody's characteristic, no matter what it is. But surely we must believe in the right to have those characteristics protected. It strikes me as odd that we see politicians continuing to apologize for what we've done to Germans in the past, or Ukrainians, or Japanese people, yet we continue to challenge and attack other groups in modern-day society today, like Muslims, like the LGBTQI community. And so I wonder what politicians down the road will be apologizing to them. Who will be apologizing for Donald Trump's pronouncements, you know, in 50 years or 100 years? Not to pick just on Trump. I think he represents a certain segment of American population. But that's new. That's new to us that he's so overt about his discriminatory comments and activities. So politicians can't be allowed to win elections on the backs of oppressed minorities, and it's up to us to make sure that doesn't happen. And we proved that in 2015. We did say no. Enough is enough, and that was very encouraging. Point number three is that we live in what seems to be a very unstable world right now, and I'm hard-pressed to explain that. The challenges of the Middle East, of course, are very immense. But I guess I have a bit clearer idea on what we shouldn't be doing as a result of some of our experiences, and some of this is contained in your own philosophy as well. I noticed President Obama visiting Hiroshima this week and offering his prayers for what happened there. And I thought that was remarkable in a way. I do think Obama will go down in history for a number of reasons, positive reasons, even though he's had a bit of a rough go as a president. I think this kind of thing gives us some hope. But yet at the same time, he's on a trip. When he's on this trip, he visited Vietnam, where you might have heard that he lifted the arms embargo on sales of American-made military equipment to Vietnam. And so I wonder about that, and the dichotomy of that, the contradiction of that, of apologizing, perhaps that's a bit strong, to the people of Hiroshima, while at the same time lifting an arms embargo in Vietnam. I just don't know what that's all about, why that's going on. And it seems even contradictory to my understanding of where Obama wants to go. But that's part of his legacy, and he'll have to live with it. I guess I just wonder why the superpowers, and I'm referring here to China, Russia, and the United States, continually feel the need to arm their allies and spread their dogmas and build new alliances, often military alliances, that will eventually become competing alliances. That's part of the world that I don't understand. It strikes me that the Middle East would be much better off today if the Russians and the Americans simply pulled out of the Middle East and let them solve their own problems. Maybe that's naivety on my part, but I have spoken to a number of people from the Middle East, and they share a similar kind of point of view. As you know, Amnesty's been on the front line of many of these human rights battles since 1961, actually. Amnesty is headquartered in London, but is in the process of establishing regional hubs now around the world in South America, Central America, Asia, and Africa. Amnesty, as you know, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1977 for the work it was doing. In Canada, we have an activist branch here, a very robust branch with two sections, both an English-speaking and a Francophone section. And I'm on the board of the English-speaking section. Here at home, Amnesty has been very busy in the last few months since October 19th, really, working with the new government, trying to inform them, lobby them, educate them on a number of issues that are important to us. We've been at the forefront of the movement to bring Syrians to Canada, and we're happy with the government's decision in that regard so far. We think there's more we can do as well. Amnesty's also been on the forefront of many of the legal battles with the former government. And again, I try not to be political about this. This might be a legal perspective as much as a political one. But you look at situations like, or individuals like Omar Khadr and Meher Arar, the denial of refugee health benefits, the denial of the right to vote for women wearing the niqab. We've called upon the government time and time again to stop spending taxpayers' money litigating people's human rights and litigating indigenous rights in Canada as well, yet they continue to do that. So we have this Charter of Rights. It's one of the most modern in the world, and yet we see the government in many cases trying to use that against them or refusing to defend their rights. So Amnesty has not only been involved lobbying, but has been in the courts on many of these cases. on the recent decision of the Child and Family Services case involving Aboriginal children on reserves. Amnesty was one of two interveners on that case, and of course we were successful in that, in the outcome there as well. So we would like to see a shift from the courts back to the House of Commons, and we've been spending a lot of time trying to get the government up to speed, get them on track, try to show a difference, really, between this government and the former government. If we are to move on as Canadians, I think we have to do that. I think we have to recognize that some of the decisions that were made were wrong ones from a human rights perspective. And this is an opportunity to try to get on, back on track. For me, one of the big things is remembering in 2000, and I just got to do the math here, I guess 2012, the 30th anniversary of the Charter of Rights, which was passed unanimously in the House of Commons. There was an opportunity to celebrate that anniversary, and instead the government chose to celebrate the War of 1812. And that just spoke volumes to me about where we were at that point in time. And so I hope we'll see a point where we can come back and have that anniversary of the Charter, maybe in the 35th anniversary next year. So we've been busy in Ottawa since last November lobbying the new government on important issues, and we have been successful, frankly, with remarkable success in some ways. Canada is in the process of implementing the spirit of the UN Declaration on Indigenous People now. That's very important to us. They are in the process of establishing the independent inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women. Again, very important to us. They have now adopted the optional protocol on the UN Convention on Torture, just to name a few. These are big victories for us. I mentioned Omar Khadr has been released. I think that my recollection was the Harper government had challenged the release of Omar Khadr on 9 different occasions in 9 different legal venues, and now he has finally been released. So these are important victories, and it's important for us to celebrate those victories as well, because so often in the human rights field we're getting used to that one step back and not the two steps forward, and I think that's starting to change a little bit. But more can be done, and it's worth reminding ourselves that Amnesty International is an international movement. It's not just a national movement. And there's a lot to be done there, of course, a great deal to be done. Some of you might be aware that in Africa, two of our contract workers were killed in the indiscriminate killings by Al-Qaeda affiliates in Burkina Faso last January. This sent shockwaves through Amnesty International, because we like to think we're on the front lines trying to help people, and yet some of our people were in harm's way. And we have to take some responsibility for that as well. Gord sent me the link to what's happening in Burundi and elsewhere. I think the Unitarians have been involved there. It's definitely in a state of crisis. Another challenge for Amnesty International, because we've been asked to agree to authorize the use of military force to try to restore civility in Burundi. And while we don't normally promote the idea of military force, there can be circumstances like the situation and the civil strife there where some kind of force is necessary to bring primarily government operatives under some degree of control. We know that corruption continues to exist in many parts of the country. I talked to a couple of you about that, about Zimbabwe and other places this morning. So there is much work to be done in Africa, and it's of particular interest to me because I have spent a fair bit of time there. In Mexico, you know that 43 of the 44 students, many of them women, are still missing, unaccounted for. A recent international independent investigation panel looked into the disappearance and determined that the government of Mexico was actually inhibiting a free and independent inquiry into the disappearance of those students. This is high on the agenda for Amnesty International, and one of the hubs is in Mexico City, and we've spent a fair bit of time working with that Amnesty group to try to bring about some justice for the families of the 43 missing students. We know the death penalty continues to exist. Did a little bit of research on that because I was curious about that. More than 600 people were actually executed last year, and that doesn't account for countries like China and North Korea where we don't have access to information. 22 countries in all continue to execute people, United States being one of them, along with Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Nigeria, and others. So there's much work to do to be done there, and Amnesty has been in the forefront of the fight against the death penalty and is now kind of renewing its commitment to that fight to try to put some pressure on some of the other countries around the world to stop doing that. Another concern of ours is the operation of mining companies, many of them with Canadian ties, continue to operate unethically in different parts of the world, Guatemala, Western Sahara, Gord will know about that, other parts of the world. What seems to be indiscriminate mining intended to benefit the company but not the country, with little regard for the long-term implications of their mining practices. In Guatemala, open pit mining, for example, that's leaving the country in ruins, all the while exploiting workers along the way in that process. This, too, is a high priority for Amnesty to try to address, and we can do that right here at home as well with some of the mining companies that are involved there. Back here at home, of course, Canada's continuing to sell armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia, and that is of great concern to us because there is evidence, strong evidence, to believe that these vehicles will find their way into the arsenals of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab and others who will do harm with them. This is an opportunity for us to stop that process. So Canadians have to stand up for these rights, stand up to their politicians and tell them again, enough is enough. Even if it doesn't directly impact us here at home. And that's a challenge for us as Canadians. We have a very affluent society. We welcome newcomers. We do what we can to try to make this a fair and just society. Again, from my work with Global Gathering Place, I have an opportunity to talk to a lot of newcomers who all have the same story about why they wanted to come to Canada, and that's because we are peace-loving. We're a peaceful country. We care about our neighbors. We care about human rights, and that's what attracts them here. And that is something we have to protect. There's no doubt about it. We have to work hard to do that. Let me try to conclude on a bit of a positive note, because I think that's the kind of person I am. So although I told you about all the disasters around the world, or many of them, there are still some hopeful signs here in Canada. I started by referring to your seven principles and the fact that I live by many of them myself. And I said that Canada was a rights-conscious society, and I very much believe that too. You just have to look at the advancement of so-called pride rights in Canada versus the United States to show how there is a difference between Canadians and Americans, between our systems of government, between our peoples. Even the American election, I think, is a good indication of how there's a difference between Canada and the United States. But again, there's a lot more we have to do here. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has given us a new hope that Canada will finally reconcile with our Indigenous population after more than 250 years of oppression and marginalization. We now have a blueprint for turning the page on that society. And each of us can do something in that regard. I think about this in terms of the ecological phrase about thinking globally and acting locally. I think we can apply that to reconciliation with Canadian Indigenous people. In other words, now's the time to ask ourselves as individuals, what can we do to reconcile with the Indigenous population? What can our local community group, what can our community association to do? That's the challenge that the TRC has thrown out to all Canadians. And they've given us a timeline for doing that. This can't be allowed to sit in the shelf forever. We have to start moving very quickly. And there's some very hopeful signs that that's actually happening. Actually, I was just on my way down listening to a radio program with the leader of the FSIN talking about that very issue. And so it was encouraging to see that they feel some hope as well. And we have to match that with actual doings. On climate change, we're not as far along. In fact, there's lots of evidence that we're falling behind. My son is a firefighter in Edmonton who spent some time in Fort Mac, and you know, I realize it's maybe not the time to point the finger at global warming for that, but you can't help but reflect on the number of climate-related incidents we've had in Canada and elsewhere, that relate to the changing climate. And so we have to do something more about this, or this will become more frequent, for sure. And I hope that there's a commitment on the part of Canadians to do that. I hope there's a commitment on the part of the next generation. I have grandchildren as well. And you look at the trend of where we're going in terms of these severe climate-related issues, and it's pretty scary. And so, again, we have to think globally but act locally. What can we do in our community to try to reverse this trend? It's very important. It's crucial. Maybe the most crucial thing when you think about it, what kind of a world we'll have if we allow this to continue along the way. So, yes, we can contribute to a world peace, and we should continue to do that by demonstrating our support for peace every day, lobbying the government to stop selling arms, trying to make sure that we're doing what we can to make this a more peaceful society. And we have accomplished so much, but there's still much more we can do. So your commitment today to the seven principles and to use the human rights advantages we have to see those principles played out in everyday life in Canada is very important. So I encourage you, I appreciate the work that you do, and I hope I can continue to be part of that in whatever way I can as well. So that's, I guess, the nature of my message today. I want to thank you for listening to me. I'm happy to take any questions if you have. Some of you have African experience. I love talking about Africa. So if you have anything you want to throw at me, I'm glad to try to answer it as best I can. Thank you very much.
Talking about Obama being in Japan, according to the Leader Post, he didn't officially apologize. Mm-hmm. He was sympathetic. Mm-hmm. And how do you feel about the dropping of those atomic bombs? When I was a child, my brother was in the Navy going to fight in the Pacific Front, and when he was home on his long leave, when they dropped the bomb, we were jubilant because the war was over and we were going to get our brother back. And then when I heard about all the thousands that were killed and all the terrible things that happened, and people said, oh, no, it was the best thing to do because if the war had gone over, many more people would have been killed rather than the ones that were killed by the bombs. Are we getting better or worse?
Yeah, that's... Well, it's interesting when Obama said that the Americans continue to be the only ones that have used the nuclear bomb. And I think that tells something right there. Several have them. Hopefully they'll never have to use them because the impact can be so extreme. And I often wonder if, in hindsight, the Americans would do that again if they had a chance to see exactly what the impact was. And so I do think it was significant that Obama was there. And he didn't have to depend on the support of his Congress to do it. It's something he wanted to do. And, you know, I certainly give him credit for that. On a related note, I'm not as happy about the issue in Guantanamo Bay. If you recall, that was one of Obama's first promises in January of 2009 that he was going to close Guantanamo Bay, and yet he hasn't been able to because the Congress won't support it. It shows that the most powerful person in the world, arguably, is maybe really not all that powerful. So, again, there's much more that I think I would like to see him do before he completes his term. But... good heavens, if it turns out to be a Trump victory, then we're going to have to go through a bunch more challenges. So, again, kudos to him for at least going to Hiroshima. That was a very important thing to do, I think.
Thank you for this. Although I get literature and so forth from Amnesty, this has really helped me have a little bit different look, and I really appreciate that. Yeah. So I've been taking notes, which sometimes we do here. I'm interested in your expanding a little bit on Amnesty's role with Aboriginal people and their rights in Canada. And you mentioned about what can we do locally. Can you just expand a little bit on that area?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, where to start? Let me start at the real basics. We know that Aboriginal people were here before us. They were self-governing. They have certain rights to the land that the rest of us don't have as the original inhabitants. I suppose you could debate that point, but it's pretty hard to argue that they do have some degree of special rights in that sense as the first people of the land here. And you know, I won't go through the entire colonial period. It happened around the world, various forms of colonization like that. But I think what is important is we have a chance to correct that now. So what do we do? I think there are several things that we can do. We can respect the treaties that they signed. It's important to remember that Aboriginal people are treaty-making people. This wasn't a hostile kind of takeover. I hope that's not unfair to say. I think they were quite willing to share the land. What they weren't prepared to do was to be taken advantage of. And so now we see the issues emerging, like resource revenue sharing, for example, where they're saying, yeah, we agreed to share the land, but not just the top 6 inches. This goes beyond that. If we want to really see Indigenous people become self-sustaining, self-governing societies, then I think we have to find ways, creative ways to do that. And the most likely, it seems to me, are renegotiating the treaties from a fair point of view. I'm quick to say there are lots of very top-notch Aboriginal lawyers now who weren't around in the 1850s who I'm sure would take us to task on some of these things. And so that's something we can do, and I think it's a real and tangible thing we can do. The other thing is to look at alternative ways to support their government. Amnesty's taken the position on free and informed consent when it comes to mining and other activities on traditional Aboriginal lands, and this follows suit with the Supreme Court of Canada's position on these issues as well. In other words, there shouldn't be development on traditional Aboriginal lands without their consent and input. Some of that is happening, and it's encouraging. Some of it doesn't have to be mandated by the government. I was involved in a process where when BHP came to Saskatchewan to start a mine in eastern Saskatchewan, they first of all sent out a group of sociologists, actually some of whom had human rights expertise, and I met with them. And they were concerned at that time, maybe it was a front, I don't know, but they were very concerned about the impact that a new mine would have on the Aboriginal communities in that area. And so they set about meeting with them all. We literally went out there, met with the leadership on the various reserves in that area, met with the people, ate with them, talked with them to find out what the impact would be. And as a result of that, they struck agreements with many of the First Nations to partner in that whole endeavor. Now, unfortunately, BHP has stalled because of the world market there. But there still exists today some modern agreements between those Aboriginal communities and BHP to be a part of the process. It's not that Aboriginal people are anti-development, but they definitely want to be a part of the decision-making process. And that has changed. The idea that somehow the rest of Canadians can impose our ideas or our beliefs or our policy positions on Indigenous people without their input is just long gone. I believe it was gone after 1969 and the Turtle White Paper on abolishing the reserves. But certainly nowadays has even more meaning as we've just gone through this period where some of our ideas were challenged from a different perspective. So I think we have to involve them at the very basic level in terms of governance, in terms of funding those governments, in terms of accessing resources, participating in the economy. One of Amnesty's key issues right now is the Dam C in British Columbia, trying to stop that because there has been no approval. There have been actual protests by the Aboriginal people there as well. So this concept that we can simply bring in pipelines or make changes and build dams and so on without their input, again, I just think is off the table. It's just not there anymore. And Amnesty is prepared to stand with Indigenous people before the courts to argue that their Indigenous rights should protect them from such activities. There's also the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Inquiry. We've asked that that be an independent inquiry, that it be beyond just federal jurisdiction, because we're afraid that non-federal actors will try to seek some immunity from the findings of that inquiry. We are on the verge of announcement there, I think, in terms of who's going to head that up and what direction it will take. And Amnesty will be there, again, with Indigenous people trying to ensure that that issue gets a fair hearing and that the results are acted upon by the government. So those are a few things that come to mind. Again, lots to do there, continues to be to do there, but some positive signs as well. Sure, happy to.
Thanks very much for talking about the courts during the conservative time in office. This may sound totally unconnected, but I think it is. There was an article in, one of the business pages, and it was talking about the process of constructing large construction projects, mines, the bypass, etc., and the adversarial relationship between the owner and the contractor, and how there needs to be a change because that's why there's all the cost overruns. So I think there needs to be a change in our own culture from that adversarial position or way of doing things and to more of a reconciliation way of doing things, mm-hmm. such has been demonstrated by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So I wonder if Amnesty talks about that the process at all when there's talk about the various human rights issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I don't think we've been involved in the bypass, but certainly I think mediation, conciliation is always the first approach. Education as well, trying to educate the public, educate the government on alternative processes for dealing with things. It's funny because I'm not sure Amnesty had the legal experience in the past or the necessity to use their legal experience as they have in the last number of years. And we just so happen to have, a brilliant man as our Secretary General and a brilliant legal mind. He has a very small team of only two or three people, yet they've been at the forefront of all of these major challenges. And I think they've been able to use the legal instruments to set the government back to a certain extent, to make them reflect on the fact that litigation is not always the best way to go. You in the legal process will know that. It's great for lawyers, but beyond that, it doesn't help us too much. And I think that's one of the experiences from the last government as well, that there, and I hope this government will pick up on that, that litigation is not always the best approach. Let's try to sit down with the people who are interested and try to work out some kind of mediated solution to some of these big problems. And they are big facing the government. We've heard that the National Energy Board just approved the Morgan Tinder pipeline, for example. But that's not the end of it, just because some regulatory body says it's okay. You still have to deal with the concerns of the people and the concerns of Indigenous people. And so we will want to be at the forefront of those discussions as well, those negotiations, the mediation. But if it doesn't fail, then more and more, unfortunately, in the society we live, we've referred matters to the court. A bit of a funny story, actually, aside, I did teach the Charter Rights course last fall during the election, and I built the whole course around how the Harper government kind of got out of step with the Charter of Rights and what the issues were surrounding that. And then, of course, right in the middle of the course, on October 19th, the government changed, and I kind of had to throw the rest of my course out and start over again, because I did feel that there was an opportunity there to kind of renew a commitment to the rights process in Canada. And I'm fairly pleased so far with the government's direction in that regard. So we'll go back this fall. We'll be able to do an update on that just to see where the government is, and this will be a part of my approach too. You don't have to litigate. In fact, the government, strikes me, should more and more be on the side of promoting the rights rather than challenging the rights. That's the irony of it all. Look at these court cases on Aboriginal rights or many of the other issues, the government is on the side of trying to limit those rights. And I'm not sure philosophically how that fits into government. You'd think that they would be more interested in promoting the rights of its citizens against others, but instead they're the ones that often find themselves on the court docket. So we'll try to change that. Hopefully that's part of the maturity of this new government, and that they will take that approach. But they have to put their words into actions as well, and we'll be there to watch them. So thank you for that.